the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is to be nourished for 1260 days. So let's start by trying to identify who some of these symbols are in 12. So who do you think the dragon is? Let's start with an easy one. Who do you think the dragon is? Satan, okay. The dragon is Satan, and he's actually identified as that down in verse 9, where it says, "And the great dragon was thrown down, the ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world." So Satan is the dragon. What about the male child? Who's the male child who's to rule all the nations with a rod of iron? Jesus is, okay? So those two are fairly straightforward. But what about the woman? Who's the woman? Yes. Specifically, the people of God. Okay, so the woman is the people of God throughout its history with God, starting with Israel, and then Israel as the church, or Israel in Christ, the church. Okay, so the people of God is the woman. Now, what do you think it's talking about when it talks about devouring, that the dragon is going to devour the child as soon as it's born? What does that make you think of? It probably makes us think of Herod, although that's not actually what it is talking about. But I will come back to Herod. What it's talking about is the crucifixion of Jesus. Okay? It's talking about Jesus dying on the cross. And when you think about how the devil was involved, how Satan was involved with Jesus' death, it says that Satan entered into Judas, and Judas betrayed Jesus. You can see Satan at work in the council and the sham trial that Jesus had to endure. And you can see Satan's involvement in the mob and the way that they called for Jesus' crucifixion and the way that Pilate capitulated. And so the devouring is talking about Jesus' crucifixion. And when Jesus died, the devil thought he won. Satan thought he won. His whole aim was to kill Jesus and thought that that would be the end of it. But then it says that the male child was caught up to the throne of God. And what we have with that is the ascension, the resurrection and then the ascension. And so Jesus died, but death did not contain him. And he was raised from the dead and he ascended to the right hand of God. Satan could not get him, not ultimately, because he was caught up to the throne of God in his ascension. And the ascension plays a pretty major role in Revelation. And we're going to see it in the next section as well. Does that make sense? Can you see how those things are symbolized? All right, so we'll move on to 7 through 12. So that first section you could kind of title as Satan's plan to destroy Jesus fails. Satan had a plan to destroy Jesus, and it failed, ultimately. I think nobody was probably more surprised on Easter morning than Satan himself when the keys to death and Hades were taken from him and Jesus was raised from the dead. So beginning at verse 7. Now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. So at first it kind of seems like there's two disconnected stories. You have the story of the woman and the child and the dragon, and then you have this story about the war in heaven, and they don't seem entirely connected, but they are connected. A lot of times when we read that section about the war in heaven, it makes people think, okay, well, that must be the story about how the angel Lucifer fell, how he rebelled against God and was kicked out of heaven. Kind of like if you've ever had to read Paradise Lost, and I usually mean if you had to read, not like if you read it of your own accord, but I mean if you had to read it, you might remember in chapter 1 that it's all about Satan being cast out of heaven with his demons. And that's not actually what this section is about, because if you look at verse 10, right after it talks about that there's no more place for Satan in heaven, it says, "And I heard a loud voice in heaven, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come." And so it can't be talking about a time prior to Genesis, because it's talking about that Christ has come. And the fact that there is no place for Satan in heaven and the fact that Christ have come are linked together. That's where the ascension comes into play again. When Jesus ascended to the right hand of the Father, there was no place for Satan in heaven. And it's hard to say exactly what Satan's role was in heaven, but we do know from some parts in the Old Testament that he had access to God for some reason, and he was able to come before God. You think about in Job, the famous passages in Job chapter 1 and 2, where, you know, Satan comes with the angels of God, and God says, you know, "Where have you been?" And he says, "I've been, you know, to and fro in the world." And that happens in both chapters 1 and 2. There's also a place in Zechariah chapter 3 that I'll read that talks about Satan in this role. Zechariah chapter 3, verse 1. And Zechariah is having a vision. "Then he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. And the Lord said to Satan, 'The Lord rebuke you, O Satan.'" So the thing is that Satan was standing there to accuse Joshua the high priest. And so in the Old Testament, this happens a couple of times. And so we don't know why. We don't know exactly why Satan had access to God to accuse, but it's just taken as a reality that he did. But that changed when Jesus ascended to the right hand of the Father. There's no place for Satan anymore. And it says that, you know, he's basically kicked out. It says that Michael and the angels made war on Satan. So it's kind of like God saying, you know, go get him and kick him out. And it says that the devil and his angels fought back, but they were unsuccessful and they were cast out. But verse 12 lets us know that while Satan is expelled from heaven, he's not done. He's not done fighting. It says, "Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short." So the devil is not finished. He's defeated, but he's going to keep fighting. Any questions on that part? So you could call that section, "Satan loses his place in heaven." So we're dealing with a defeated enemy. All right, the third section in verse 12, you could call "Satan attempts to destroy the disciples of Jesus." Satan attempts to destroy the disciples of Jesus. "And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring and on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And so I will freely admit, I don't know probably what most of that means. The stuff about the great wings of the great eagle and the flood and things like that, and what time and times and half a time. I don't know really what that means. But what we do need to know from that section, I do think, is pretty plain. Satan knows that his time is short. And because his time is short, he's going to inflict as much damage as he can while he can. And while a lot of that is not clear, one thing that we can draw from it is that as Satan attacked the people of God, he was unsuccessful in stamping out the people of God. Satan was tried to eliminate the people of God, but it shows that he was unsuccessful. And one writer says that Satan is like the Wile E. Coyote of the spiritual world. Remember Wile E. Coyote from the Roadrunner cartoons? Like every trap he lays for Roadrunner fails. And Satan is kind of the same way. He tries something and it doesn't work, and he tries another thing and it doesn't work. And he's ineffective in being able to stamp out the people of God. So what he does is he launches a new strategy where he's going to go after the disciples of Jesus. He is going to go after those, it says, who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And you think about last week in the context of emperor worship, the one commandment that we talked about was, thou shalt not have any gods before me. That's the commandment of God that it's talking about. The testimony of Jesus is that Jesus is Lord. There is one Lord, and it's Jesus. And when you say that Jesus is Lord, you're also saying that the emperor is not. And so the dragon goes to make war on those who will not bow down to the emperor and who are faithful to Jesus. And at this point, the original readers of Revelation would have been able to see themselves in the picture. They would have recognized, okay, this is what's going on. We are not going to bow to the emperor, and so the devil is making war on us and inflicting this pressure on us. And so Jesus' ascension prompts a war against the saints, is basically the summary of chapter 12. Any questions? Anything unclear with that? I know there's a lot of figurative language and symbolism, but I think the message that we can draw from it is fairly clear. Yes? It does, but it's not. I think it just means like a short amount of time. So it's not like 70 years in Daniel, that kind of thing. So it's not a really long amount of time. So like I said, 12 talks about how we got in this war, but 13 shows how the dragon makes war on us. And so we'll move over to 13. And this first section you could just title, Satan Summons a Beast from the Sea. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads and 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? So a couple things to note. First, the sea is a place of chaos in the Bible. The sea is always depicted as a place of chaos. You did not see people out water skiing on the sea. It was a place that people feared. And in Revelation 21:1, it says, I saw the new heavens and the new earth coming down, and the sea was no more. The place of chaos in the new heavens and the new earth is gone. And the description of the beast follows Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel has a vision of four beasts arising from the sea in succession. And those beasts each represent a different empire. And so here, original readers would have been like, okay, we see what's going on. Here comes another empire out of the sea, and it's the Roman Empire. That's how they would have understood it. But the way that this beast is described with the 10 horns and the 7 heads, you know, it's kind of like father, like son, because that's how the dragon was described. The dragon that made war on the saints was described as having the 7 heads and the 10 horns, and the beast is the same. The Roman Empire has the same character of the dragon, which is an evil character. And yet the whole earth, it says, marvels and follows. And they worship the beast. And, you know, worship is how we, what we orient our lives around. And so if we are worshipers of God, if we're worshipers of Jesus, our lives are oriented around the Lord. But it says that those who marveled and worshiped the beast are those who have their hearts and their whole lives oriented around following basically the power structure of the world, which was the Roman Empire, and staying in its good graces and believing everything that it was telling them. So Christians would have understood this as the Roman Empire. And as much as people marvel about it and praise it, what Revelation wants us to see is that it's really a monster. It's really a hideous monster that's emerged from chaos. The people don't see it because they're deceived. And those who don't follow Jesus are deceived by the evil one. And they're almost destined to follow after evil because they've not surrendered their lives over to Jesus. All right, next section is 13:5-8. And you could call this "The Beast Begins Its Conquest." And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and language, tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. So the beast utters blasphemies, has no regard for God. Has no regard for God whatsoever. The beast does not realize or forgets that it's a created thing and that God has created all things, and it's just a created thing. And God was uncreated. And so the beast has no regard for God. And the way that we should understand that and the way that the early Christians would have understood it is the arrogance of the Roman Empire, because it uttered blasphemies against God, especially by wanting everybody to worship its emperor. But it was arrogant, seeing itself as an infallible power. And it makes war on the saints, and it says that it conquers them. And it says that it conquers them. And so one of the questions that's been asked in recent years is whether or not the United States is an empire. And I don't know if the United States is an empire. We're certainly a world power, but I don't know if we're an empire. If we are an empire, what unites us as a nation is our idolatry for freedom. It's our idolatry for freedom that unites us as a nation. And then we then export that wherever we can in other nations and around the world. Now, I'm not talking about freedom from tyranny. I'm not saying that there's something wrong with wanting to not have tyrants governing over us. But I'm talking about freedom from restraints, freedom from limitations, and freedom from rules. And so, you know, in our culture, in our day, if you're pregnant and you don't want to have the baby, then you can, there are ways to deal with that. Because you should not be, in the attitude of our culture, you should not be saddled with a child that you don't want. If you are a man and you would like to become a woman, then there are ways that that can happen as well. And it's become more and more prevalent in our society that that's an absolutely acceptable and okay thing to do. Made even more prominent by a certain celebrity going that route. And like we talked about last week with same-sex marriage, The whole thing is to have, the whole idea of our culture is to have no restraint, no limitations, absolute freedom. Whatever you want to do, it's okay to do it. And those who would impose rules and who would impose traditions that stymie that are the bad guys. And we do have to realize that in the eyes of the world, we're the, you know, we're basically the bad guys when it comes to restraining freedom. So that if we are an empire, we are an empire that way. But in the Bible, not all empires are bad. Some empires are actually good and they're benevolent in the way that they treat the Israelites. King Cyrus lets the people go back to Jerusalem so that they can build the temple. Constantine is considered, you know, generally a benevolent ruler. But what makes an empire a beast, specifically in the Bible, is its persecution of Christians. And when an empire, those in power, persecute Christians, they're characterized as a beast. And the more that we defend God-imposed restraints, the more we are going to be attacked. And the things that we talked about last week, some of those examples, you can kind of see how the beast rises up to attack. Whenever we say, you know, life is not meant to be lived without restraint, without limitations. God created us a certain way, and if we try to live apart from that, we're going to destroy ourselves, and we're going to destroy other people. And whenever that comes out, we're just ripe for attack. But like I said, Satan is a deceiver. And those who are not surrendered to the lordship of Jesus, they will swallow that line of thinking about having total freedom with their lives. And they will follow and they will marvel after the beast. Does that make sense? All right, one more section. And you could call this, a second beast makes things worse. Second beast makes things worse. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has an understanding nature calculate the number of the beast, for it is a number of a man, and his number is 666. Like I said, we're not going to get into the whole 666 thing this week, mostly because I don't know. There are a lot of theories, but wasn't really particular to the message that I wanted to talk about this week. So, some notes about the second beast, or some ways to understand the second beast. It says that two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. So, in its presence, a lamb is benevolent and harmless and friendly, and Jesus is described as a lamb. So to the watching public, to those who would be deceived, there's no threat. It's non-threatening. But it speaks like a dragon, meaning it speaks with the character of evil. Speaks with the character of evil. And this second beast, later in Revelation, is called the false prophet. It's kind of like the propaganda manager, the marketing manager for the beast. It controls the messaging and the things that people hear, so the way that people understand the beast, and so that they will worship it and that they will want to maintain good relations with the beast. And then a little bit further down where it talks about the image of the beast that is given a mouth so that it can speak, that's talking about the emperor. Okay, so it's the image of the beast is the emperor. The emperor rules over the empire, and so it's the image of the beast, but it says that it's allowed to talk, and those who don't worship it are slain. So it's referring to the emperor itself. And this beast controls, like I said, it controls the messaging, controls the media, but it also controls the market. Because it says that all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, have to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, and they can't buy or sell on the market. Remember we talked last week that you were expelled from your guild if you didn't worship the emperor? That's kind of what this is talking about. If you didn't have the mark of the beast, if you weren't approved, then you got expelled from the market. You couldn't work, you couldn't buy or sell, you couldn't support yourself. You were basically impoverished or going to starve to death. And people, in order to participate in the system, had to be kind of branded like cattle, receiving a mark just to prove that they were in. And it's all about who's in and who's out. And so if you were living in that day, that was the main thing. Are you in or are you out? And in our day, there's a lot of are you in, are you out. Just goes by different labels, right? And, you know, as far as controlling the market, you know, I think about when the Religious Freedom Reformation Act was passed in Indiana at the end of March, and you had Apple threatening to boycott, and you had Salesforce threatening to move. And then when the law was going to be passed in Arkansas, Walmart threatening to leave. And so you have these companies with big clout throwing around, you know, their financial power. It's not much different from what we're talking about with this second beast of controlling the market to make things go their way, to conform to their ideology. And if you don't fall in, then you're left out. And same with the messaging, the media. Because, I mean, raise your hand if you think that Christians got a fair shake over the whole RFRA and some of these other lawsuits. Raise your hand if you think they got a fair shake from the media. No. Because the media is part of it. And the media is part of worshiping the beast, of worshiping this idea of unlimited freedom and freedom from restraint. And because SSM is such a part of that, they're fully on board with it. Does that make sense? You see how that all kind of ties together? And so, again, how Apocalypse works is it reveals, it unveils, and in this case, it's unmasking what's behind emperor worship. And it's the dragon waging war on the people of God, waging war on the disciples of Jesus. And for those who would say, well, it's not a big deal, just worship the emperor, you don't have to mean it, you know it doesn't mean anything, but just do it so that you can work your job and support your family and stay out of trouble, what John is showing them is, well, you're basically worshiping a monster if you do that, a monster from the pit of hell. And so don't have any illusions about where this is all coming from. It is a big deal. And I think the same message could be said for us as well. Okay, so any questions about 12 and 13? If not, I have 3 points of application for us then. And by application, I mean how I think God intends to shape us as his people through Revelation. Okay? So the first one is that Satan has lost, and he knows it. What Revelation wants to tell us, wants us to know, because we're in the thick of this battle, is that Satan has lost, and he knows it. He's kicked out of heaven, and he knows that his time is short, and so he's going to inflict as much damage as possible. So the persecution that they felt, that the Christians felt, and that we feel, is part of this agony in the throes of defeat. And I think of a couple of different pictures with this. One, I think of a basketball team that's down like 40 points in the second half. It's impossible for them to come back and win. They're not going to come back and win, but they decide that they're going to try to take out as many of the opposing players as they can. They're going to go for knees, and they're going to try to disable the players on the other team out of vindictiveness and out of spite. So Satan knows he's defeated, but he's trying to take out as many players as he can. The other image I get, if you've ever seen Lord of the Rings or if you've ever read the book, is the scene where Gandalf confronts the giant demon, the Balrog, and is able to overcome it, and the Balrog falls into an abyss. But on its way down, it snaps up this fiery whip that curls around Gandalf's ankles and pulls him down with it. And that's how I picture Satan attacking us as disciples. He's defeated, he's on his way down, but he is trying to pull as many down with him as he can while he still can. Does that make sense? And the way he's doing it is not to kill the people of God. That's not actually a strategy that works. Jesus said, don't fear those who can kill the body and after that do nothing. He's talking basically about the devil and those who work through him. The way that the devil can defeat us is by driving us away from God while we live. And what he was doing to those first Christians, to the Christians in the seven churches in Revelation, was using persecution to drive a wedge between them and God, so that the people would see death and persecution and impoverishment and losing their ability to make a living, and then that would begin to push them away from God, to where either they would just out of bitterness reject God altogether, or they, more importantly, they would compromise their faith just to try to get back in. And they would renounce God, they would worship the emperor so that they could just get back to life as it was normally lived for them, to get back to how things were. And so in our lives, there's so many things that come up, so many issues, problems, tragedies, difficulties, and what the devil wants to do is to use those as a wedge between us and God, to move us out of faithfulness so that we will trust God less, so that we will serve God less, so that we will be ineffective, and so that we will be fixated on our problems and not trust God with them. Does that make sense? So Satan's lost, and he knows it, but he is still a dangerous enemy in that regard, because he will try to drive a wedge between you and God and use difficulties in your life to do so. And that's why when we do have difficult situations, when we do have trials, it's so important to walk it out with people, because they can help us see things in a more clear light and remind us of God's faithfulness. Encouragement is me reminding you, or you reminding me, of God's faithfulness. Encouragement is not, you're a great guy, you're going to come through this okay. It's, God is faithful, and he will stand by you throughout this trial. So that's number one. Number two, Satan cannot accuse you before God. Satan cannot accuse you before God. And that's not just because he doesn't have the right, he doesn't have the access. For all its symbolism, Revelation is pointing to real truth, and the truth that it's communicating is that Satan lost whatever access he had to accuse you before God. He had it once, but he doesn't have it anymore. And I want to go back to that passage in Zechariah chapter 3. Oops. Then he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. Anybody ever feel like that? You ever feel that you are being accused by the devil, reminded of your sins, reminded of your shortcomings, your failings, a sense of condemnation on your life? Satan has no access to do that before God. Now, that's not to say that he's still not going to accuse you, but God doesn't hear it. God doesn't hear it. And instead of hearing accusations, God sees Jesus, the Lamb slain for the sins of the world. Remember, Jesus ascended to heaven, and the devil was kicked out. So God sees the Lamb slain for the sins of the world. That's what he sees. He sees our lives covered by the blood of Jesus. He doesn't hear the accusations of Satan about your life. You may still hear them, but you do have to tell yourself, it doesn't matter to God, you know, and so I'm not going to be defeated by it. All accusations, whether they're made by the devil or whether they're made by the public, again, like talking about last week, if you're called hateful or if you're called a bigot or whatever, all those accusations fail in the eyes of God. So that should be an encouragement to us, especially if you wrestle with condemnation. And number three, Satan has a very limited playbook. Satan has a very limited playbook. So as we read in chapters 12 and 13, here's Satan's playbook. Deception, coercion, manipulation, threats, and murder. Yawn. It's not very creative. And he does it over and over again. It's all he knows is to destroy and to kill. As Jesus says in John, I think it's chapter 10, the thief comes to kill and destroy. That's his play over and over and over again. He's been doing it since the beginning of time and at least as far back as Pharaoh throwing babies in the Nile. And so, talking about Herod, we know where Herod got that play, you know, to kill all the babies two and under, straight from the dragon himself, because that's what Satan does. It's a limited playbook, and it makes him very easy to spot. And so when you see things like ISIS, when you see things like executions in North Korea and things like that, you know who's responsible and you know who's at the back of it. And when we see things in a different mode in this country, of people being forced out of businesses and things like that, like we talked about last week, you can recognize that's the beast. And you know, just know where that's coming from. The opposite of that, God's playbook is infinite. God's playbook is infinite. And so Ephesians 2:10 says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." There's an infinite variety of good works that we can do. And I think of the passage in Romans 12 that says, outdo one another in showing honor. You know, that there's no limit to the creativity that we could go in showing one another honor and in serving one another. It's an expansive and creative playbook of love that God has. God in the flesh died on a Roman cross for the sins of the world. That was something that nobody expected, nobody looked for. And that's the source for all our love and good deeds. And so, I guess a question for that is that how you see good works? You know, do you see yourself and your life available to an infinite variety of good works on behalf of others? And backing up to the previous two application points, because I did have questions with those that I accidentally went over. Under the one Satan is lost and he knows it, is Satan able to move you out of faith when difficulties arise? Is he able to get in your head and to get you to distrust God and to use negative circumstances in your life in order to drive a wedge between you and God? And then the second one about accusation, who are you listening to? You know, who has your ear? Does Satan have your ear about your life, or does God have your ear about your life? So those three questions, I think, they could be good home group discussion questions or good journaling questions, but to think about the fact that Satan is a defeated enemy, but he is still he's still around. He's a prowling, he roars like a prowling lion seeking whom he can devour, says in 1 Peter chapter 5. But that doesn't mean that we have to let him conquer us. Is that good? Now, so this week was about the war waged upon us. Next week, we are going to talk about how we take the field in the war in following the Lamb and the Lamb's way of taking the field of battle. That's what we will talk about next week. But what I'd like to do, Kyle's going to come up and he's going to play a song. I'd like us to worship, And I would also like to, we don't do this a whole lot, but I'd like to open up just the front. If you'd like to come down and pray, if Satan is able to deceive you and to discourage you through negative circumstances, through trials, through difficulties, or if he is able to accuse you and you take in that condemnation and you live with it and it becomes real in you, or if you've just been ineffective with regard to good works, and you'd like to repent of any of those things, and if you'd like to turn that over to Jesus as Lord, I just like to invite you to come down and pray and do that, an act of repentance and a prayer of decision to give that over to God so that you cannot be conquered by the enemy.